Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Research at the National Archives and Beyond Blog Talk Radio. This is your host, Bernice Alexander Bennett, and I want to welcome the callers and chatters to Research at the National Archives and Beyond. This show will provide individuals interested in genealogy an opportunity to listen, learn, and take action. Well, special thanks to the Blog Talk Radio team for featuring Research at the National Archives and Beyond on their homepage all day today. Now, you can join me every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, while I will have a wonderful lineup of experts who will share resources, stories, and answer your burning genealogy questions. All of my guests share a deep passion and knowledge of genealogy and history. If you have logged in as a guest and wish to participate in the chat, you can sign in through your Facebook account or Blog Talk Radio. I may also open the lines in the second half of the show so that you can ask questions of the guests. Following the show, you are invited to post your questions and or comments in the Genealogy and History Forum of AfroGenius.com. Also, I have recently launched my new website, www.geniebroots.com. Check it out and let me know what you think about it. Well, tonight's show is all about oral histories and personal memoirs. What do you know about your family history? Have the elders shared stories with you? Have you considered writing your personal memoir that includes the oral history of your family and community? Well, my guest, my special guest tonight, Mr. George Jeter, will explore the value of gathering oral histories, documenting, and sharing those personal memoirs. New York native and New Mexico photo restoration artist George Jeter calls himself an evangelist for African ancestor genealogy. And we will find out exactly what this means. In 2007, George Jeter was featured in a segment on the PBS television show History Detectives about his second great-grandfather, who was a soldier and veteran of the Civil War, and I truly enjoyed that episode. George Jeter, along with his wife Cynthia, received the prestigious 2012 Award for Community Development from the New Mexico Office of African American Affairs. So let me give a warm welcome to Mr. George Jeter to Research at the National Archives and Beyond. George, welcome.
Oh, thank you, Bernice. Thank you. Thank you very much. Oh, I enjoy your show so much. You're doing an incredible thing here with Blog Talk Radio, and I'm just happy to be a part of it.
Well, thank you so much, and I'm happy that you are a part of episode number 43. So, 43. This is 43. So, how and why did you get involved in genealogical research, photo restoration, and more importantly, George, why do you call yourself the evangelist for African ancestor genealogy?
Okay, wow. Let me see. Let me start at the beginning. How I got involved in genealogical research. In November of 1977, my father passed away. And in his possession was a photo album of old postcard-type pictures and tintypes. And these people in these in the pictures I didn't recognize, but I knew they had to be my family. And, of course, in 1977, Roots, the miniseries, was on TV. And that also triggered my beginning interest into genealogy research.
Uh-huh.
Let's see, you asked me about photo restoration.
Yes.
A buddy of mine, we started a photography business in 2005 and in California. And my buddy, Curtis Corum is his name, my buddy, he was the principal photographer, and I was the touch-up man or the Photoshop man. So working on photos for our clients and at the same time looking at some of the old photographs, particularly the tintypes that were in my father's photo album, I said, well, let me restore these. And it's a labor of love, and anybody who really spends time doing photo restoration, they can call themselves an artist. So I call myself a photo restoration artist.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, you asked me, what was the other thing you asked me?
Why do you call yourself the evangelist for African ancestor genealogy?
Oh, okay. I kind of stole that evangelist idea from a guy named Guy Kawasaki, who labeled himself as an evangelist for Apple computers. And because he loved the company that he worked for, Apple, and he loved what he was doing, and he called himself an evangelist because he went out and sung the praises of his company and its product. So I said, what I should do is I should sing the praises of African ancestor genealogy. Because I've noticed, like in genealogy, like in any other industry or institution,
yes,
or entity in the United States, people of color are often marginalized and placed on the sidelines and have a difficult gaining access in this area. Now, mind you, I'm not talking about specialization. I'm talking about access. As an example, there wouldn't be a need. This is going to rankle some feathers here, but what I'm about to say, there wouldn't be a need for AfroGenius.com if the law, because, you know, the laws of research are the same, there wouldn't be a need for AfroGenius.com if folks were allowed the same level of access from the very beginning when they started genealogy. And I say that because when I first started and started going to some of the societies, I wasn't welcomed, and it wasn't easy access. Folks didn't share anything with me. They made me feel unwelcomed. So I discovered, as a result, I discovered AfroGenius.com and where I was welcomed. And I said to myself, I'm going to be an evangelist. I'm going to do everything I can to have African ancestor genealogy placed on the map, have people be aware of it, have those that are of African ancestry have a place to go and a place to have a voice and to be recognized in this in the larger world of genealogy. So I've taken it upon myself to let folks know what they're getting, who they're dealing with, and where my heart's at. And that's why I call myself an evangelist for African ancestor genealogy.
Well, thank you. And this is wonderful because you're right. Access is pretty much the key. And if you, as you said, AfroGenius was one of those places where you felt welcome and they had information to share. So let's move on and talk about oral history. How would you define oral history?
Well, oral history, I'd say that oral history is a way or a method of gathering information and stories from individuals, from folks about their lives, their views, their witnessing of everyday and historical events. Typically, it's done by way of audio or video or even written transcriptions.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of a basic definition for oral history.
So are there any particular guidelines someone should follow to gather an oral history?
Yes, and there's many places online where you can go to, you know, find out about oral history. But I would say a couple of things. I would say a good guideline is to don't let technology get in the way. And by that I mean don't come to your elders loaded with a whole lot of stuff that you don't know how to operate or you have difficulty operating, big bulky cameras and video cameras and stuff like that. I have a little story about that. I had met some new cousins in early 2000, and they went to interview my uncle, my namesake uncle, and
mm-hmm.
they were loaded down with the camera, the tripod, and all that, and it just got in the way. I saw the video, and my uncle was just concerned about all this fuss and commotion.
Yeah.
So I'd say don't let technology get in the way. Simplify your stuff. Use your iPhone. Most iPhones have the capability of recording. Set it on the table. Set it aside. Get your elder, your interviewee comfortable,
mm-hmm.
and then let it rip. So the other thing I would say is don't let you, the interviewer, get in the way either.
Okay.
Perhaps ask a few basic questions, get your interviewee a little bit warmed up, and then just step out of the way and let them talk.
Mm-hmm.
Trigger a memory. I go back to that same scenario with my cousins interviewing my uncle. One of the things that happened in that particular session, besides the camera and being in the way, is that my cousins were asking questions that they had partial answers to.
Yes.
And so when my uncle was speaking, they were challenging him. Oh, we heard it this way. Oh, we heard it that way. Oh, isn't so-and-so related to such-and-so, so-and-so? Things like that. And what
mm-hmm.
it did was it flustered my uncle because he was close to 90 years old.
Yeah.
And he was very articulate. And he knew the stories. He lived them. And he had plenty to tell. But as the cousins were challenging him, he shut down. He decided that, they don't want to hear what I have to say, so I'm just gonna shut down and give yes and no answers.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
that was a shame. That was a shame.
Yes, because it was a loss. It was a lost opportunity for
yes.
them to get as much as they could.
Yes. And
so you're saying just to start off, as you said, with a few warm-up kind of open-ended questions and just allow the rest to flow.
Yes, yes, and just get out of the way because it's that important. Especially with African ancestors folks, there's a lot of disremembering. There's a lot of denials because of the hardships that they endured during going backwards during the civil rights movement, during the Jim Crow era, and if they go back further than that, there's just a lot of unpleasant things that they would rather not talk about. But there's a way of gently coaxing them, and then just get out of the way so that the stories can come out.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they remembered an event, a fun event, and that might trigger, oh, yeah, but when we had this happy time and when we went home, we encountered ABC, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That story would never come out if you press them or badger them. So we just have to be extra sensitive.
Right. Well, would you recommend sending questions in advance or just right then and there starting your question process?
Sending questions in advance is almost like a crapshoot.
Mm-hmm.
Because you could end up shooting yourself in the foot. They might see some of these questions, depending on the questions. They might see some questions and say, uh-oh, no, I don't want to go there. Oh,
mm-hmm.
They're trying to get me to talk about this, that sort of thing. So it's a 50-50 proposition. You can do it and hopefully meet with success, and you can also do it and not get an interview at all.
Well, how do you, or at least what kind of advice can you give to individuals who know that there's some kind of secret and the person is unwilling to disclose what that family secret is? How do you go about even bringing up the subject in your oral history taking process?
That's a tricky one too. You really have to make the interviewee comfortable in sharing that information. They have to be comfortable with you. They have to trust you. Trust
mm-hmm.
is a big factor.
Yeah.
Without that trust, you won't get anything. And I would try to let them come up with that information. You can probably lead them. Or an example, I'm just going to make something out of my head right now. You may have heard that that the interviewee was part of a bus strike that went bad, and they don't want to talk about it. But you might know of a fun excursion that they took, and it may have involved a bus. And you can kind of beat around the bush that way. And they might say, oh, yeah, I remember another bus ride, those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because you want the stories, but you don't want to shut them down.
That's right. And then you don't want to bring up a memory that's so painful that, as you said, you could shut them down and that would be the end of it.
Exactly. Let me tell you what happened with my uncle.
Okay.
A few years later, after that botched interview, I'll call it a botched interview. My cousins, I love you, but it was botched.
Mm-hmm.
When I went to visit him, he was in Martinsburg, West Virginia, and I hadn't seen my uncle in years, oh gosh, 15, 20, 30 years, I hadn't seen him. So when I got there, you know, we had a wonderful time. And the first day he was showing me around Martinsburg or whatever was there. And we just kind of chit-chatted and stuff like that. The following day, I said, well, you know, I want to know about the family. And he knew that. He knew that that was part of the purpose of me coming there. And he says to me, the first thing he said to me was, okay, I'm going to tell this to you and you only.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want you to pull out a camera. I don't want you to pull out a tape recorder. I don't want you to pull out a pencil and pad. I don't want you to pull out anything. I'm just going to tell from my lips to your ears. And I was like, oh, my gosh. And that was a result of the damage that was done, you know, a few years prior. Because he had a lot of things to tell me. And without betraying his, he's passed away now, but not, but to not betray his confidence, he was telling me things about lynching. He was telling me things about Jim Crow.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to our family? He was talking about the cooling board. Folks
yeah.
know what the cooling board is. And,
why don't you tell everyone about the cooling board? Some may not know.
Okay. Well, the cooling board is like a board platform where you set a deceased body on. In this case, one of my granduncles was murdered, and they put the body on the cooling board to preserve it in a way so that they can have time to bury it.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And so my uncle, he witnessed that, and he went into graphic details about that. That story would have never came out with my cousin, going back to my cousins again,
yeah.
Because of the way they conducted the interview.
Uh-huh.
So you got to kind of pay attention and be in tune with the interviewee and honor their wishes and just don't get in the way and let the stories come out.
And that's just excellent advice. Well, George, there are a couple of questions coming out of the chat. One of the questions is that have you had any success getting family members to send written stories?
Family members to send written stories?
Yes.
I had a cousin in Buffalo, New York. I was in Binghamton, New York, 200 miles between the two cities, and the cousin sent me a letter that included the family lineage that was in the family Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And I was surprised at that. And once they got comfortable with me and they trusted me and they realized that I was going to be the de facto family historian,
mm-hmm.
they sent me the actual Bible. And I was just blown away. There couldn't be a better story to send me than the family Bible.
Right, but it also goes back to that whole trust.
Exactly.
When they finally, you know, realized that you were the person, the keeper of the information, they went that next step now and sent you the Bible rather than just information that was in the Bible.
Exactly, yes. And, I was just floored by that. And what we did was at a subsequent family reunion, some of the younger folks, some of the younger kids, the nephews, gathered around, and we tried to figure out the handwriting, who wrote what in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
The first entry was one of my second great grandfathers, who was born in 1756, and he died in 1860. And so we tried to figure out who wrote that in the Bible. It was fun. It engaged some of the other members of the family to get involved with the genealogy search research.
Oh, that sounds like a lot of fun. How old was that Bible?
The Bible had a new binding on it, but the page said the copyright was 1876.
1876, okay. Probably one of those Sears Roebuck Bibles.
well,
I'm just saying that. I found a bunch of them on eBay.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Uh-huh. But, you know, there's another question coming out of the chat, because it's just wonderful that you were able to, as I said, and as you said, gain that trust and get that Bible. But what about that audio recording again? I mean, you said don't let technology get in the way. But have you had success with audio recording?
Oh, yes. I've used the smallest recorder I could get. I would use, back in the day when we were using cassettes, I would get one of those small portable cassettes rather than the big bulky ones where you had to, you know, press the keys and all that kind of stuff. Because I wanted to be, I didn't want the technology to be the centerpiece. I wanted to be able to put the recorder off to the side so that it becomes, you know, just not noticed by the interviewee.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, as the technology developed, I would use the digital recorders.
Yes.
And they work quite well. And they had digital recorders with USB connectors for those that are about the technology. What I find now is that the smartphone just works wonders, because everybody has a smartphone. Elders recognize smartphones. It's easy to set on a table, and it's easy to ignore. Make sure you press the record button. So that's how I would do audio. I would just get the smallest, most decent thing that you can use, because you're going to transcribe it anyway. You can transcribe it, and if you got a good smartphone, the audio quality is going to be good enough that you can use it if you want to use the audio portion and put it in a online or something like that.
Now, when you are ready to conduct this oral history, do you disclose how you will use that information so that the person is fully aware of any comments they make that you are going to do something with it?
Absolutely. And with family, of course, there's full disclosure. And then, of course, with clients, there's full disclosure. And I always offer that they are welcome to listen to the final product, and whatever they say they want taken out will be taken out.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of that trust thing again. I would caution against recording somebody and then say thank you and goodbye and split. You know, I wouldn't do that. I would always come back to them and here's the product. Let's listen to it together. Tell me what you think, what you like, what you don't like, and I'll do everything to make it to their wishes.
Yes. Now, another coming out of the chat again. How do you obtain the permission to tape or to record the information? Is it a form that you have people fill out, or is it just a verbal agreement? How do you do that?
Okay, I do both. Mostly with family, it's like a verbal agreement. But if I have a client, it's a contract, and the items are specified in the contract. That's to protect me, and also to protect the client.
Now, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back because I want you to give us some examples of oral histories. And I have a question to ask you, though, and it's about the WPA slave narratives. Would you consider those slave narratives of oral history?
Oh, okay. You want me to answer that now or?
Before we take the break, yes.
Oh, before we take the break.
Before we take the break, yes.
Okay. Let me see. What was the question before the WPA stuff?
When we come back, you can give us some examples. I just wanted to get the WPA slave narrative question out of the way.
Oh, okay. Okay. I would say yes and no to the slave narrative. Let me think here. Yes, because you know, they are of value because, you know, there was a an interviewer and an interviewee, and the subject was you know, what was life like during slavery, and so there's a gathering of information there, and so I think that's of value. I kind of say no, because the yes and no part of it is because, well, let me think. I read somewhere where there was an attempt at writing the interview, writing the in the exact dialect as it was being spoken, and part of the problem with that was getting the message correct, getting the information correct, and that there was a lot of corrections that had to be made, and in those in doing those corrections, there is now interpretations being made. So
yeah.
When
okay.
when that happens, you know, the information is changed, it's altered, so it's no longer pure, and it can no longer be regarded as, you know, the actual statement or the intent of the interviewees. So you know, there's a problem there. With some of that, so that's why I kind of say no. Also, you know, there's another side to that is, okay, these folks were interviewed in the 1920s and the 1930s, and they were living under Jim Crow and all the hardships of the day at that point when they were being interviewed. And they're being asked to, talk about their life during slavery. And they're being asked by this stranger, this government representative, and you have to wonder, you know, they all ain't dumb. What are they going to tell this guy? Or this lady who's asking them all these questions, you know, who are they? What are they going to use this for? Do they trust? Do they trust this person? So when you're reading those slave narratives, I think you have to kind of read in between the lines and try to figure out if the interviewee was on the up and up, were they telling the truth, or were they telling what the what the interviewer wanted to hear, what the government man wanted to hear, and then was the government man interpreting it correctly when he was doing his writing or his editing? But that's why I give it a yes and a no.
You give it a yes and a no, because for some, they may find that their ancestors were a part of this project. So at least it did put their ancestors at a place and time where they did share something. But then on the other hand, you're bringing up the whole trust issue and perhaps a fear issue. Maybe I need to answer this question this particular way, because if not, there may be repercussions. Well,
yeah,
it's
absolutely.
Definitely something for us to think about as far as oral histories are concerned. But we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to have just a special announcement from Tanya Browder. And so I'll bring her on in 1 minute. So quick break, and we'll be back in a minute, okay?
Great.
Welcome back to Research at the National Archives and Beyond Blog Talk Radio. This is your host, Bernice Alexander Bennett, and you have been listening to Mr. George Jeter share with us some basic guidelines on conducting oral histories. Well, before we bring Mr. Jeter back on, I'd like to introduce Tanya Browder, who is the director of the Tompkins Library in Edgefield, South Carolina. Tanya, are you on?
I am.
Well, Tanya, what do you have to share with us tonight?
Well, I would like to let your listeners know that we have a great workshop coming up in September, September the 28th and 29th. It's called the Southern Studies Showcase. And we would like to just invite your listeners to go to our website, which is www.oedgs.org, or call the library at 803-637-4010 and find out about this event that we're really excited about. We've got historical and genealogical societies from all over South Carolina coming to this event, and we're just really excited about it.
Right, and that's September the 28th and 29th in Edgefield, South Carolina?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, well, thank you so much for calling in. And by the way, folks, I'm going to be giving two workshops at that, at least two presentations at the Southern Showcase. So please try to come out. Well, thank you very much, Tanya.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, well, we're back to George Jeter. And, George, we're kind of moving on with our discussion about oral histories. So would you give us just some basic examples of oral histories you have gathered?
Sure, Bernice. Well, I'll give you some examples of interviews with my family. So, because I haven't talked to too many clients who I could have get an agreement to share their stories with. But I'll start with my mother, Pearl Hancock Jeter. Here's her oral history story for me. When I was in grade school, I asked her about her ancestry, and she said she was born in 1911 in Williston, South Carolina. That was it.
Oh.
That was
wow.
It. That's
a long oral history.
Yeah, that was it.
Okay.
I thought maybe I better not ask too many questions from anybody. So years later, I'm talking to my Aunt Sadie, and Aunt Sadie is my mother's sister. Aunt Sadie Hancock, and a similar question, about the past. Can you tell me something? Well, she was the first one of the family to tell me this particular story, and other people confirmed it. When they were kids in Williston, South Carolina, Aunt Sadie was one who liked dresses and frilly things. She was looking in a store window at a dress, and the clerk came out and said that she had to move along because, blacks weren't allowed to look in the window of the store. And you'd have to know my Aunt Sadie, even as a kid, she was a feisty little kid and kind of stubborn. The long story short there, she stayed too long. They got the constable, and the constable took her, and she's a little girl, 7, 8, 9 years old, took her and threw her in the holding pen with all the drunks and all the bad guys. And my uncle, who was with her, witnessed this. He ran, and he got his father and his uncles, told them what was going on. And so they gathered up all the women folks. This was a Saturday, I believe, and they went into town. And they're sharecroppers, so they had a day off. They went into town, and this thing happened to Aunt Sadie. So they gathered up the family. They went to the jailhouse, the holding pen, and they had revolvers. They had 44s, and they shot in the air, and they broke the door. And they got little Aunt Sadie out of there, and they got in the buckboard, and they left. This is between, I don't know the exact date, but sometime between 1915 and 1920 that this episode took place.
Mm-hmm.
So what had happened there was, so they went to wherever they were living, to their home, and the townsfolk wanted to lynch my grandfather. But somebody said, no, leave him alone. He's a good worker, sharecropper, farmer. He's a good worker, leave him alone, and we'll deal with this some other kind of way. So that's an example of an oral history story that if you get in the way, you'll never hear it.
And how many times was that story shared with you?
It was shared maybe two or three other times. It was confirmed completely when I visited my uncle in that I had mentioned earlier in Martinsburg, West Virginia. I asked him about it, and he said, "Yes, that's a true story." And he said, "Here," and he repeated it, and he told me about his involvement.
Uh-huh.
So there's those kinds of stories. Now, my uncle George, some other examples of oral history. He was a very instrumental person in getting the YMCA integrated.
Uh-huh.
And I never knew that growing up. One of those things of I didn't know, I didn't ask, and he didn't tell. But at this point, he felt comfortable with me. Again, it's that trust thing.
Uh-huh.
And he told me about how he went. He was a they were called an executive secretary, and he went around the country integrating YMCAs. And another interesting story that came out of him. I hope I'm not being too long-winded here, but there was a YMCA that was going to be opening up in Washington, D.C. And he was instrumental in getting it opened up, and they were going to have a ceremony, and they were going to have the ceremony in the colored high school. I got to do some research on the name of the high school and all that. My uncle passed away. But it was a colored high school, and it was in ill repair. He was able to talk to members of the Daughters of the American Revolution, the DAR, and get them to have this celebration at Centennial Hall. And, of course, you know the story about the DAR and Marian Anderson. So this was after that, and he was able to get Centennial Hall to put on this ceremony for the opening up of this new integrated YMCA. And he thought that he needed a celebrity to kick things off. And he thought about Jackie Robinson.
Uh-huh.
So he contacted the organization. I think he was playing with the Dodgers, Brooklyn Dodgers, or I'm not sure. But they were in training in Florida, and the coach would not release him. But my uncle was of an influence that he got members of the, he told me, the members of the FBI that he was friends with, and they went down to Florida, and they talked to the coach, and the coach released Jackie Robinson for one day to help with the celebration of opening up the integrated YMCA and in Centennial Hall. Now, that is, you know, a story that that was just tremendous. I wish I had known that when I was growing up.
That wow. And so there's probably some documentation that you can go back and verify that story.
Yes, yes. In his, he had a long
By the way, phone. What year was this? Do you have any idea what year?
I'm not 100% certain on that. I still got to do more research on that.
Yes.
But it was after Marian Anderson was not allowed to sing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was in that time period.
Right. But the point you're making, though, is that the stories are there. I mean, the stories are there, but you have to be a willing listener, no doubt about it, and you have to gain that trust. And
yes.
So you've given us three stories, and those are stories that perhaps you would not have gotten if you hadn't been willing to listen and engage in that dialogue. So after interviewing your elders, why is it so important to write your own personal memoir or autobiography?
Well, because as you learn that, you know, stuff happened to them, your elders, stuff happened to you. And, you know, those stories are important as well.
Uh-huh.
You're an eyewitness to history.
Uh-huh.
And I would even say that when it comes to doing your oral history for your family, start your autobiography and start it before you interview your elders. That way you can put a lot of things, you know, hopefully in a better context. Ideally, you'll be ahead of the game when you do your actual genealogical research. And
uh-huh.
by that, those that are familiar with my blog and my writings, I tell stories about what happened to me or what I encountered.
Uh-huh.
And those stories, in turn, trigger ideas, thoughts, and concepts and avenues of research for me when I'm dealing with the stories of my elders and my ancestors.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes there's a common thread between yourself and your elders and your ancestors. I think it was noted on one of Henry Louis Gates' programs when he interviewed Oprah Winfrey, as an example.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, she's an educator. She's a teacher of sorts. And her story, you know, complements the story of her ancestors. One of her ancestors built a school, and there were educators in her ancestry. So when you know about yourself and you tell those stories of the things that you've encountered,
uh-huh.
it can only help you with understanding some of the stories that your elders have told, and it could lead you to some interesting places of research.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, let's just go back to that theme. So how does your story compare and contrast with, let's say, that of the historians, both past and contemporary?
Yes. What I'm going to say there is that, and I think this is kind of critical, it has to do with the narrative. When you think of historians have an enormous task, whether they're, you know, the seekers of the absolute truth, or if they're subjects of the ruling class, you know, thereby scripting a monolithic point of view. I know I kind of went off there for a moment. But let me give you an example of what I'm kind of saying there.
Mm-hmm.
My eighth grade history teacher told me and my class that I was only a Negro. And since there's no country called Negro, the word Negro does not have to be capitalized, and it means nothing. Now, I bring that up to say that that's a narrative. That's a narrative that my eighth grade history teacher was imparting on my entire class. And it was kind of side story to that. It was doubly embarrassing because I was up at the blackboard and I had written that and I had the word Negro because that's what I knew at the time, and I had capitalized it. And the reason why I capitalized it was because in the previous class, which was an English class, we were learning about proper names and capitalization of names. So my classmates, I'm the only black kid in the class, so my classmates are, you know, their ancestry goes to Scotland, so they're Scottish with a capital S, or England, and so they're English with a capital E, French, capital F, so on and so forth. So what I could do is I could put Negro with a capital N. And life was good. The English teacher said, okay, you know, and the bell rings, and we go into the next class, which is history class. And so we had a kind of like a similar lesson plan going, and there I am up at the board, and the teacher tells me, nope, it's got to be a small N, and what I just told you. So it's like the, it's the narrative that is so important. And what I say to by being an evangelist for African ancestor genealogy is that I suggest that all genealogists and family historians can reclaim and gain back control of the narrative by way of their research and publishing their stories. And that goes across the board. That's all cultures. We're in a unique position by doing this research, going to the archives, reading the newspaper accounts that are online, et cetera, et cetera. We are finding out, we are discovering that there's another story on, and that the narrative of what we had learned in school might necessarily not be the truth. So I think we're in a unique position, thanks to the internet and all that it brings, to change the narrative that some of these historians have, you know, shoved down our throats over the years.
Right, and you're also telling this story from what you lived and how you felt and what that experience meant to you. And it does shape it in a different way because it's your personal memoir. It's not somebody else telling it for you. You're telling it.
Exactly.
This is what it meant to you to stand in front of that desk, I mean, in that teacher, and have that teacher tell you, no, it's not a capital N, it's a small N.
Exactly. Yeah, and, you know, we all have those kinds of stories. Everybody has those stories. There was a, and I just posted a story this week on a website called Your Story Coach. They asked me to write a little story, and I did. And that story was about, I called it, quote, another bus story. And I was thinking about, at the time, I was thinking about the famous bus story that we all know in that took place in Montgomery. And my particular bus story had to do with me and my mother getting on the local bus, and I was always a tall, skinny kid. And really tall for my age, and I put my money in the coin slot, and the bus driver insisted that I pay the adult fare, and my mother said no, he's not an adult yet. He still pays the child fare, and here's the birth certificate to prove it.
Uh-huh.
And the bus driver didn't want to go with that. He wanted her to pay more for me, and she wouldn't do it.
Uh-huh.
So that particular story is online. What had happened was, long story short, we did take the ride, but the bus driver, he kind of lurched the bus, and my mother bumped her head against the front windshield,
uh-huh.
and she sustained a cut, and so she was bleeding. But when we got to our destination, and we were going to my godfather's house, and my godfather and my mother, they all had a powwow, and they just sent me outside, and they were going to deal with this issue. And I don't know how they dealt with it, but they dealt with it. But it's a story. It's a narrative of what happened to me and in my family. And it's those kinds of stories that need to come out from everybody, because those stories can change the narrative. Now, my story took place in upstate, quote-unquote, progressive New York.
Uh-huh.
But it has the similar tones of what was going on down in the South. So
you're so right. You're so right. I mean, just listening to you, I'm hosting the show, but I have so many stories going through my head. And so you're right. If everyone would just sit down, even if it means what happened to me when I was in third grade, I mean,
exactly.
There's something that you have experienced that becomes a part of you, and it shapes your attitude. It shapes your being. And so what impact does your story have on society, culture, and education?
Well, knowing the impact is like, well, knowing the truth about what really happened, and in
uh-huh.
the context of your own, in the context of your own personal memoirs. It'll help you to know who you are,
uh-huh.
and where you stand,
uh-huh.
and so you know what to do. You'll understand your culture, which is your life support system, by the way. I maintain that too. Your culture is your life support system. So, you know, just get in touch with your culture. Now,
uh-huh.
you said education. When I look back on my education, I wonder what would have happened if I had known, most folks know that I was on the history detectives, but what would have happened if I had known when I was in grade school that my second great grandfather was a soldier, a freedom fighter in the American Civil War?
Mm-hmm.
Instead of reading Little Black Sambo out loud in my third grade class, or even the illustrations in my history books of the happy slaves eating watermelon. That's the narrative that I had when I was going through school.
Uh-huh.
And but the truth is, if I had known about my second great grandfather, and that's one of the things that you got to try to be gentle when you're doing your oral interviews, so that those stories can come out.
Yes.
I had mentioned that my mother never said anything, and I actually really didn't ask my father much when he was alive.
Uh-huh.
And I had made mention of this photo album that he had. Well, he had hidden that photo album, and it only came to surface when he had passed away and it was in his possessions. He hid it because my mother, who was great at disremembering things, she would have looked at that and said that it was old and thrown it out.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't want memories, those kinds of memories around. That was, I don't know, that was her makeup.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that my father hid it, because my mother would throw away precious stuff. My father was a musician, and he had those silver, I remember those silver plated albums of his music. And, you know, one year in a fit of spring cleaning, they were gone.
Uh-huh.
That sort of thing.
Yes. Now, you have these memories. You're collecting this oral history. But, George, mm-hmm. how do you store, you know, the interviews? I mean, just what kind of materials do you use to store them? And then when do you get to the point where you're ready to roll it out into a memoir?
Let's see. I do the recordings, and then I transcribe them. That's painstaking to put them into a document,
mm-hmm.
or to put them in an audio. Well, put them in an audio file is easy, but to put them in a document, that's painstaking.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes time to roll them out, I don't know. I'm trying to write a book. It's been taking me forever. I've
mm-hmm.
told folks that I'm writing this book, and here I am. I'm still writing this book, where I'm going to put, you know, with my family, put that information in a book form, because I think there's some interesting stuff there that can help other people to, you know, think and consider, as you were saying, to think and consider your own personal stories and kind of go from there. If you're asking about particular pieces of technology that I use, nothing more than, you know, some of the Windows products, Photoshop. There's an audio program called Audacity, which
mm-hmm.
is an open source program that's good for editing audio, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we're still talking about this, the oral history. Have you encountered any surprises conducting oral histories and writing your personal or other memoirs?
Some surprises, some funny little things. One of my sisters and I, we interviewed our Aunt Letty. Aunt Letty is not actually a blood relative, just a close friend of the family, and we always called her Aunt Letty. And so we got with Aunt Letty one time. We were starting our doing our family research, and she knew about our grandfather. And our grandfather, he passed away in the 1940s. So I never saw him. He passed before I was born.
Mm-hmm.
And so Aunt Letty was telling us that, oh, yes, your grandfather Emmett was his name. He had a girlfriend, and she was a hunchback. And my sister and I, we kind of like, what? You know, not quite what we were, you know, seeking out, but, and what do you mean granddad had a, you know, had a girlfriend, you know, and we didn't want to hear that, but it was humorous, and I say that all in humor.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing of it was, one of the interesting things, surprising thing is that Aunt Letty, as we called her, she turned and she looked out the window, and she was living in a second floor apartment. She looked out the window, and she was seeing folks walking the street, up and down the street,
mm-hmm.
folks that were gone 50 years ago. And she was saying, oh, there goes you know, there goes your grandfather now. And my sister and I, we kind of looked out. And instead of saying, Aunt Letty, no, there's nobody out there, we just kind of sat back and let her talk. And so we got some little gems of what was going on back then. And it was amazing. It was amazing. Another example of getting out of the way and let the stories come out. She was seeing characters from 50 years ago.
And so what you're saying, that there was a little dementia, or this is just the way she was? She could go back and think about what it was like, and she could share with you the characters she was seeing.
Yeah, I wouldn't quite say it was dementia. I would more, I would say that it was mostly she was just remembering. It was just a matter of just letting her go and let her tell the stories.
Right, and it's really, in a way, it's a nice kind of place to be when you're listening to someone and they just kind of get into that storytelling zone.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see it. You can see them take on a totally different posture because it's feeling good to them that they're in that zone and they're seeing things and they're sharing it and you're not stopping it. So I think that you've kind of touched upon on something that perhaps others may want to think about. Well, there's a question coming out of the chat, and it's about, let's say you may have some old tapes. How do you store these tapes? Let's say they're 15 to 20 years, and you want to transfer them to some type of newer media. Just, have you done it? And if you haven't, what would you recommend?
Yes, I've done it. Received from my new cousins, I received some audio tapes, audio cassette tapes that were, 20, 30 years old, and they were becoming brittle. And I kind of talked them into letting me have them. I would recommend getting those things transcribed and the information transferred to the latest media. If that means getting them transferred to CDs, CD-ROMs, or DVDs, do that, and don't hesitate to do that. You can go the route of getting those converters. I've seen them at Target and places like that, where you can go from VHS to DVD, et cetera, et cetera. But you might want to consider a professional doing that. I'm here in Santa Fe, and there's a company that does that professionally. And what I did was I took my tapes to them, and they did a transferring from audio cassette to DVDs, and I was pleased with the results, professional results, and they were painstaking and did it right. So,
Have you considered, for some people, they have these old tapes and they're ready to throw them away. Would you recommend that they donate the tapes and the recordings to a library or some repository?
Yes, absolutely. If they're getting ready to throw them away, good heaven forbid, reconsider and go to your local historical society or your local museum and ask about if you can donate those items to them, some kind of repository. And if that fails, get in touch with me. I'll take them. I'll take them. They're just too precious to discard,
to throw
away.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I see Antoinette Harrell in the chat, and I know that she's donated just all kinds of materials in her collection to to two outstanding institutions in Louisiana. So for those people who have floppies, who have CDs, who have documents that they feel they just don't want, don't throw it away.
Absolutely.
Donate it.
Yes.
Call George.
Yes.
call George.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Well,
don't
you
put them on eBay.
Okay, George, great. Well, George, do you have any recommended resources to assist the listeners as they begin the journey of writing a personal memoir?
Yeah, I thought about that. There's a couple of books that I would recommend that are real helpful. And one of them is by the author is Hasker Nelson Jr., and he wrote a book called Listening for Our Past. And he gives valuable tips about doing oral history, what to do and what not to do. Hasker Nelson Jr., Listening for Our Past.
Mm-hmm.
You can find it on Amazon. It's a small book. I think it's only like $10. That sort of thing, but it is tremendous. I keep that by my side all the time. And you can't get out of this without reading. And you should read biographies and autobiographies.
Uh-huh.
They will give you the flavor of what you want to consider writing. A good
uh-huh.
one is Sidney Poitier's The Measure of a Man, a spiritual autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
Just listening to his way of describing things, his voice, is tremendous. And you can learn from him how to go about doing your own personal memoirs.
Right. Very good recommendation. I know I used to love reading about the Delaney sisters.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
Yeah, yes, because they just told this just very, very interesting and colorful story of their lives.
Yes, and they were down to home. You know, they were folksy about it.
Yes, so, real folksy. And
mm-hmm.
in fact, I guess one of the things when you're talking about writing your personal memoir, let it be your voice. You can't write it in any other person's voice but your voice, and that's what makes the story so interesting and so compelling for others to want to read it.
Absolutely, yes. And another place on the internet to go, you know, I got to give props to AfroGenius.com. You know that's where everybody of African ancestry needs to go first. You need to go to AfroGenius.com.
Okay,
yep.
Okay. And AfroGenius.com, of course, you kind of moderated book reviews and what have you, so that would be a good place to go and look at some of the books that you have actually reviewed. Well, do you have any parting words to the listeners before we close out tonight?
Parting words? Yes, consider your story. Your story is just as valuable as the story of your elders. I know in terms of genealogy, we rush to interview our elders because, you know, time becomes short. But also your story is valuable, and your story in connection with history, what's going on. You're an eyewitness to history just as your elders and ancestors are.
Mm-hmm.
Those stories are important because they're the stories that are going to be passed down to your children and grandchildren and descendants that aren't even here yet. So personal memoirs and autobiographies they're just vital. And they also help you with your genealogy going backwards.
That's
right.
That's right. And it's just something to just think about. You know, when you wake up in the morning, what's on your mind? Maybe put it in writing. Share it. Well, George, I want to thank you so much for joining me tonight and providing the listeners just with this valuable information on how to gather an oral history and write a personal memoir. So let me tell you about what's going to happen next week. I guess most of you probably understand or know that the U.S. transatlantic slave trade was abolished in the U.S. March 27, 1807. But did you know, of course, that the domestic slave trade continued? And so next week I'm going to have Claire Cluskins. She's a genealogical projects archivist for the National Archives and Records Administration, and she's going to talk about the Slave Manifest. I refer to it as the Slave Ship Manifest, filed at New Orleans, Louisiana, between 1807 and 1860. Now, some of you will know or may recall that there was a slave ship manifest for a slave ship called the Cheyenne, and that slave ship arrived in New Orleans in 1849, and on that ship, it had a woman by the name of Harriet Watson, who was born in 1815. Well, I immediately claimed Harriet Watson as my ancestor and went on this crazy plan to find that slave ship and everything I could find out about it.
Wow.
Well, Claire, oh, yes. Well, Claire is going to give us the details. She's going to tell us about the domestic slave trade. And let me tell you, folks, you will find that with the slave ship manifest, you had first, last names, descriptions. You had the name of the owner. You had where they were picked up. Claire has done all of the research, and believe me, you want to hear what she has to say. So please join me next week, because we're going to hear about the slave ship's manifest to New Orleans between 1807 and 1860. So good night. Oh, yes, George, I'm so excited about this.
Yes,
as I have been excited
about
every guest every single solitary week. So good night, and thank you, George Jeter. And remember, your ancestors left footprints. Therefore, you should follow the clues that are presented to you through oral history. George just told us about oral history, family records, research at the National Archives, and beyond. You can continue this discussion on the Genealogy and History Forum of Afrogenius.com. Also, if you want to know more about what's happening with research at the National Archives and Beyond Blog Talk Radio, like my Facebook page. Also, remember the African Roots podcast tomorrow morning with Angela Walton Raji and Nurturing Our Roots Blog Talk Radio with Antoinette Herrero every Sunday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. So thank you so much for joining research at the National Archives and Beyond. This is your host, Bernice Alexander Bennett. Good night, and I look forward to you joining me next Thursday. Good night, and thank you, George. Good night.
Yes, thank you. Good night, Bernice. Great show.
Thank you. Great show. Great to have you.
Yes.